first Yes to Life show of 2017. I'm Robin Daly, and I'm looking forward to bringing you as my guests on the show a huge range of experts from the field of integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology. I shall be talking to researchers, practitioners, oncologists, and activists, as well as people with personal experience of cancer, to find out what's new, what's working, and why. I'm starting the new year by speaking to a highly qualified and enormously experienced naturopath, Dr. Zandria Williams. I have a particular reason for wanting to talk to her, in that during 2016, she began training a new generation of naturopaths and nutritionists to meet the challenges of supporting people with cancer, an enormously complex and demanding task requiring a thorough background knowledge of the underlying biochemistry. She now has plans for the coming year to develop this training into a full-blown course. So I went to visit her at her practice in central London to find out more. Hi, Zandria. Thanks very much for coming on the show again to speak to us about your training courses.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
So 2016 seen the launch of your training programme for naturopathic support of people with cancer.
Yes.
After a long, demanding and fulfilling career in naturopathy, both as a practitioner and a lecturer, most people in your position might be thinking something a bit more relaxing at this point in life. What's made you want to start up a complete new training programme at this point?
Well, I got very interested in cancer when I first came to back to England and found that instead of being a naturopath almost on the same level as a GP, medical doctor, people here sort of said, oh, we don't know what you do, or, you know. And I thought, no, I'll take a break and do some research. So I did the research into cancer,
right, which
I found absorbing. I've always enjoyed researching and biochemistry and put the two together, and it's great. I've variously been involved with lecturing in this country in a number of colleges, and I do find the improvement is fantastic in the last 20 years in the training here. But whereas the naturopathic diploma I did in Australia was over 3,000 hours of training in 3.5 years, here I think it's about 600 hours.
Wow, that's a big difference.
And it's a huge difference,
yeah.
And people are taken into a lot of the courses not even knowing the difference between, say, a molecule and an element. You know, they don't have sort of school science even.
Right.
So it's more of a difference. And so I worked at that for a while, and I thought, well, no, nobody really wants to explore that much, you know. And because I'd done all this work with cancer, I still lecture at some of the colleges, but less, and mainly focusing on cancer or a few key subjects that I'm interested in within that, for various reasons. So I started then I wrote the Vital Signs for Cancer Prevention book, the first one. Then Cancer Concerns, which is about getting things started and some of the foundation approaches of people like Otto Warburg and John Beard and William Kelly and so on and so forth. Then a few people said, would I do a seminar? And then it was quite clear one seminar wasn't enough.
Right.
And so that developed into, in my head at any rate, a series of seminars. Seminar SL, we call it, one, which is based pretty much on Vital Signs for Cancer Prevention, although in this country, that's the American title, in this country it's just called Vital Signs for Cancer. And seminar level two is based somewhat on the second book, Cancer Concerns. And to those two seminars, we have patients, their carers, any level of students, any level of practitioners coming. We actually find very often the students know more than the people who have been in practice for years, partly because you forget certain things once you're in practice, and partly because the courses have changed. And then I planned SL3 and SL4, and it was very clear that SL3 wasn't one day, it turned out to be 4 days, looking at all of the supplements that you would put together to support somebody with cancer, with whatever other treatment they wanted, in some detail. And we based that on a very good test that American Metabolics does in Florida that will pick up the presence of cancer, not necessarily a tumour, because the wording here is kind of tricky, but the cancer process whereby cells have started to go wrong at the molecular level, maybe 5 or more years before there is a tumour. So I started, obviously the practice grew like crazy once I started doing this, and we've had hundreds of people going through doing the CA1 profile, which is this one. And then I was very lucky. I met up with Olga Galkina, who runs the Galkina Laboratory down in Dorset. And she's Russian trained, and her research in Russia is into all the sort of things that we should be using in this country but don't. In Russia, what we think of as alternatives, they do in their hospitals.
Mm.
And she has a huge array of tests that she does, out of which I cherry-picked about 8 or 10. So that once you know somebody has cancer, it's not enough just to give them the general supplements that we know that help, never mind sort of beta-carotene and vitamin D things, but resveratrol, lipoic acid, CoQ10, because we know they work within the mitochondria, within the cells. But you want to know more about the individual characteristics of the cancer cells in that individual. And with the Galkina Laboratory's results, we can look to see things like we have a protein that makes sure that every cell replication is perfect. And if not, it either makes sure that error is put right, or that cell kills itself. And if that's mutated, and it is in well more than half the people with cancer, we have to put it right. And there are plant remedies that will put it right, or that have been associated and reported in medical, scientific, respectable literature, showing that studies using those substances led to a reduction in mutated protein. And then the same thing is true, because I'm fundamentally a biochemist. I don't believe in anything. I want to, you know, have the trials and tests. Not trials just on do it and it worked for so many people, but also how it worked at the cellular level. So there are other compounds that either encourage cells to commit cell suicide if they're faulty.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others that try and stop that happening. And if either of those are out, they're obviously working against each other, then we have ways of changing the supplement program so that we encourage the proper level of cell suicide. And so it goes. I mean, there are cells that develop, well, any tumor is a growing mass of substance, and it needs a whole lot more blood cells to stay alive. And if somebody's got an excessive amount of cell of angiogenesis, of new blood vessel growth, then if we can stop that, and again, there are plants that we know do stop that, without having any other bad side effects, except that if you stop that and therefore stop a new or growing tumour getting new blood vessels, you do have the chance of stopping a wound healing, because you're also needing new blood vessels for that.
Mm.
So we don't just jump in and say, oh, take this, it's good. But say, look, we've done the test, this is the result, it's 4 times what it should be, and often it's more than that even. This will bring it down, but if you get a cut, or if you've just had some form of surgery, let that heal before you go back onto the remedies. And so it goes on.
So this is what you would describe as a functional medicine approach, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Where you test first, find out what's wrong, and then
correct.
Do the things to correct what's yes. wrong, rather than
yes.
just try some of this.
Absolutely. This try this and see if it works is what the medical profession's been doing for the last century. They've tried, I don't know, 10, 20,000 different chemicals, maybe a whole lot more than that. Who's counting? And try this, try this, try that, try the other thing, without any thought as to how it might be working. The lack of thought in the medical world as to how a cancer started is frightening. They'll say, oh, there's faulty genes, but why are there faulty genes? They're not inherited faulty.
No.
They haven't gone from 6 people per 100 to 50 people per 100 getting cancer in their lifestyle in only, what, 3 or 4 generations of one century. It's not happening. So we do look for, Yes, why and how.
What are the drivers?
All that happens.
Mm.
And yes, to that extent, it's functional.
Right.
And so then we've got to teaching seminar SL3, 4 days. And then I just thought, this isn't really quite what I want. I mean, part of me would like to start a college, but I think this is...
How big a part?
Yeah, well, a very large part would like it to be there. I mean, see, in Australia, I ran the nutrition and biochemistry department of a college that was teaching 400 or 500 students a year and was a 3,500-hour course. So the nutrition and biochemistry was hundreds of hours. And I ran and worked in that in two different colleges there for 20 years. You know, I like the structure. I like to see people doing everything they need to know and then see them coming out really being able to understand it. Yeah. So when I was teaching biochemistry here in England, it would be, look, here's this all terribly boring biochemistry of carbohydrates, but if somebody's got diabetes, you'll find this thing here in this metabolic pathway is up and you can use it clinically in 2 years' time. And, you know, you've got to learn all these lipids, fatty acids and the ketones and this, and then tie that into ketogenic diet. So trying to always, particularly in the 20 years I've been back here, connect a solid fundamental biochemistry to a really alive clinical situation.
It's interesting because there's a tendency for those to be two distinct disciplines, isn't there?
Oh, yes.
You're either a biochemist or you're a clinician. You're not.
What I found at the college, I've got about 20 or 30 or more emails from students saying, God, I went into the first biochemistry class thinking, God, this is going to be ghastly.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, you inspired me as to why I came to the college and why I'm doing things.
Yeah.
It's not really up to me. It's there. The science is there to bring what we know to life. And what we know happens is better underpinned when we understand the science behind it.
Sure.
There's no point in teaching people want to do naturopathy, how you get an OH here and a this there, and this makes it an aldehyde, and that makes it a ketone, and boring.
Mm.
But if you can bring it down to, if you've got this pathway and this enzyme here is up, you know that there's not enough oxygen getting into the mitochondria, so you better do this and this because you need lipoic acid to get through there.
There's real practical consequences.
Absolutely.
Mm. Right.
So the course that I'm now planning, which is where we kind of started,
yeah.
I'll get there, is we're starting next September. It'll be 2 days every 4 weeks or thereabouts. There'll be 11 or 12 weekends in the year. I can't say exactly how much long it'll go or how long it will last because I don't know how much the students will know. It's for practitioners,
mm-hmm.
and people who've done a nutrition diploma. Even if they just graduate in August, they can come in September, even if they've got one assignment to do. But they can't be less than that because when we go through something, and I'm talking about, okay, you need this because it does this on the electron transport chain, and somebody says, what's the electron transport chain? Then I'm going to tell them.
Hmm.
We might have a side sort of bulge.
Right.
I'm not going to just rush on and say, here are the recipes.
Right.
Because I want to have... You know, I'm not at the start of my career. I hope I'm not at the end. But I don't want to have a whole lot of people knowing how to apply a recipe and not knowing what to do if the recipe doesn't work.
Right.
And they will have a given... on top of that, they will have... We haven't decided yet, but at least 3 mentoring sessions. They will have 3 patients of their own or friends who are worried about cancer or something who'll come and see me. I will run through the patient what I would do, but I'll be able to say, look, you need to do so-and-so, and to the student or who's doing the course, that's what we discussed in week 4.
Right.
And then I'm hoping that the student will go on working with that person with different consultations and then write up the report or come back with me, with the patient or without, and say, I did this, I did that, but I don't know what to do next. So if they do at least 3 of those, and then at least once a month here we have open house for patients. They come along on a Friday evening, usually the first Friday in the month, and they bring a plate of raw food, low starch raw food, organic and everything else, And they all tell their stories, and sometimes it's heart-rending, and sometimes it's really inspiring. You hear of people, how they've coped with this, how they dealt with that, something they discovered. And somebody else said, oh, I did that. I thought we were the only people doing this, you know, because they don't get this mixing.
Mm.
And then everybody shares their food, and it develops. Mm. And so by the students in the course coming to as many as we can fit in of those, at least two for each student, because we can't overwhelm the number of patients with the number of students,
right.
They'll see what it's like really at the coalface.
Right.
And they'll be writing assignments and doing things on the way through, and then we're looking at having a, I thought it was called a hub, but apparently it's called a network or something, an area on our website where people who are doing the course have a password and can access. So we'll be putting material up there for them all the time that they can get to and access.
Right. So it's a heady mix of being extremely strong on all the theory and the principles, but also very hands-on.
Absolutely practical.
Mm.
And it's probably going to be a first level and a second level.
Right.
I mean, I only thought about this whole thing last Sunday.
Right.
And we're now
work in progress.
Well, you know, we've got so many people already wanting to do it, and we had there are 12 people who work here with me in the practice or support the practice actively, had a sort of party last night for Christmas, and they thought it was fabulous, and there was such enthusiasm, and all the ideas have been coming in. But I think the first period of so many weekends, and maybe it's the whole first year, I don't know, will be entirely for people are supporting people with cancer who are doing chemotherapy, they're doing radiation, they're doing surgery, they're doing whatever they work. Because however much you support somebody to restore homeostasis and get them back to good health at the cellular level, it's got to work with and help them through whatever else they do.
Right.
And then if there's the enthusiasm for it, SL4 and 5, as I had them planned, will enable people to help people who are just refusing. We're not trying to stop people having chemo or radiation. We can't and we shouldn't, and it has to be the individual's choice. But there are some people who say, well, I'm not doing that anyway.
Right.
What will I do? And then, you know, we'll take it on further.
Mm. Marvellous. Okay, well, look, these are very lofty ambitions you've got.
I know. So. But
it's
hey,
great.
If you don't have them, you don't get there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's great. But anyway, I know how well qualified you are to do this job, but would you perhaps tell our listeners?
Me?
Yes, why you're qualified to do this job today.
All right. Well, I go back to when I was 5 and I got 100 for all my arithmetic exams, and I could never see why anybody else didn't, because it was logical that 7 and 3 made 10. Then I discovered science. Well, hey, that was much better than that. Then I discovered chemistry. Well, that was obviously the best science. So then I went to Imperial College here in London, in South Kensington, and did a Bachelor of Science of Chemistry there. Then I went out to New Zealand and did a master's degree in chemistry again, with actually at that stage a geological slant. I was in the mining industry for 10 years. But I was also there when I swapped, well, I was in Australia, when I swapped from geochemistry to biochemistry, which I loved. But in the meantime, I'd come back to London at Imperial and done another master's level degree here in analytical techniques. In Australia, I did the whole naturopathic training and started
talking. 3,000 hours.
Yes, it's well over 3,000, but you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we did three days a week of 8 hours of lectures plus weekend clinics for 3.5 years.
Mm.
And it was full on. And it was a really rewarding challenge and education, the like. And then when I started in this test for cancer, I got interested in it and cancer, and I was in London. I got interested in cancer, and I went traveling around America and went to some of the different, like Frank Wewell in People Against Cancer in America, and Emil Shandl down in Florida with this CA1, his laboratory there, and I went and spent a week or more with Pamela, somebody, sorry, I forget her name, who'd worked for about 5 years with the dentist, William Kelly, in Texas. And, you know, I got interested in all of that. But one of the things that Emil Shandl in Florida said was that he's a very enthusiastic man. I think he's got at least 1 3/4 feet on the ground, but he's got enough off the ground to be very explorative and developing this amazing test. But I did find him saying, well, you know, if you don't have HCG, then you don't have cancer. But then when I was back here and at different times talking to oncologists, they'd say, oh, well, HCG is really only useful if it's female reproductive cancers or prostate.
So just tell us what about HCG.
HCG, okay. Every time any woman gets pregnant, she potentially has cancer. The placental cells and the cancer, and placental cells and cancer cells are the same thing. They're not like each other, they're identical. And Beard, the embryologist, John Beard, who had been being thought of for a Nobel Prize until he got such ridiculous ideas outside the accepted medical belief, recognized that the placental cells and the cancer cells are the same thing. You can't tell the difference. And if you think about it, the placenta has to do exactly the same as metastatic cancer. I say it to patients, and this is a very big room. What is it, 25 by 18 or something? If this was the uterus, and then I suspect a little embryo of one sperm and one ovum would probably be the size of a sort of a pinprick. And that's in danger every month of being flushed straight through the system and out. So this little embryo develops the trophoblastic cells that are part of the placenta in time that are able to cling on and immediately dig into the uterine wall like a metastatic cancer. And they do this by putting out things like MMP2 or MMP9, the matrix metalloproteins. And when that happens, the uterine wall puts out and says, hey, hello, welcome, and puts out some as well to sort of help it in cancer or in pregnancy. And also the embryo's got to stop the mother's immune system being active because dad's sperm's in there, it makes it foreign, and develop new blood vessels and do all the things that metastatic cancer has. And then Beard recognized that on about day 55 of the pregnancy, the embryo's pancreas starts to work. Now this makes no sense at first sight.
Because it doesn't need it yet.
The embryo's not eating, it doesn't need digestive enzymes, mother's doing that. The mother's managing the blood sugar levels, so the internal insulin-producing part of the pancreas doesn't have to work. But the pancreas of the little embryo, it's hardly got a pancreas, you know, it's got this immensely important job of stopping that whole rapid growth and invasion. If not, the mother gets choriocarcinoma, which is pregnancy cancer, and they both die unless it's treated. So what had then developed and Emil Shandl took on was the understanding that if you could detect any HCG in a man who would never get pregnant or in a woman who knew they weren't pregnant, then it could be cancer developing. I did the test on one woman, and we were looking for sort of 1 or 2 or 3 units of HCG, and I did the test on one person. She had about 100,000. I thought, my God, how cancerous can you be? And then sanity prevailed. So when she came in, I said, do you think you're pregnant? She said, oh, I could be. Oh, am I? But so HCG is that compound. The thing was, Shandl said, if you've got it, you've got cancer. If you don't have it, you don't have cancer. The oncologist said, look, it might be useful as a test for breast, ovarian, uterine, cervical, or prostate, maybe colon, but none of the others. And I thought there's a contradiction here.
Right.
So then, and that's when I wrote a thesis that I submitted on the very early detection of cancer, because I went through a vast amount of the research medical literature, and there are over 80 different locations of cancer where HCG is raised. So I did a lot of research into that as well.
Mm.
And that's got me where I am, and I think that answers your question that was posed some time back.
Well, it was an interesting little diversion there, that question, because all of that to do with Beard and his work and everything, it's so foundational, really.
Absolutely.
To your thinking and to a lot of other practitioners' thinking. But actually, is it talked about? Is it known, that
no.
fact that these are identical, the cells?
Well, it's known. But you see, the thing is, round about sometime middle 19, what was it, 2030, something like that, radiation was discovered. Gosh, we can use radiation to kill cancer cells. Wow. Mustard gas, First World War, they suddenly find that that kills off the white blood cells. We could use this for leukemia. Now, this was exciting. Multinationals are drug companies. They can make things. They can do things here. And here in 1924, you've got definitely Nobel Prize winner Otto Warburg saying, we now know the fundamental cause of cancer and the solution, and it's really very straightforward, and anybody can do it. It's caused by lack of oxygen into the cells, or mitochondrial failure, lack of what he called active groups, because we hadn't really discovered all the vitamins and phytonutrients then, the presence of toxins and stress. And stress in any seminar or anything on cancer has to be also looked at. So you've got all this high-tech profit margin potential on the one hand, and just sort of across the way, you've got people saying, no, you've got to eat more supplements and nutrients. Supplements weren't so much available. Get rid of the toxins. There's no profit. There's no excitement. There's no money for a university grant or a university research bureau. So it didn't happen. And that's still where we are. We could, 100 years ago, have
it
just
It is still where we are in one
it.
Way, but in another way, I mean, I think I find it an exciting time in as much as
the
top
there.
End of science, people right from the top are beginning to make all the right noises now about...
Look at Seyfried.
Exactly.
And his amazing book, Cancer as a Metabolic Process.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you have to love biochemistry, but that's riveting. You can't put that book down.
I can put it down, don't you worry. But I'm sure you can't. I bet you love it, yeah.
I read it straight through.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But, you know, but for me, it's very heartening indeed that people of his calibre are beginning to buy some
Absolutely.
Of this stuff now and to really get the science out in a way which is, you know, you can't shoot it down. So it's very different to how it was 10 years ago.
It's very, very different. The disheartening thing... slightly is that still no profit.
No money.
In what we can call a metabolic biochemical approach.
Right.
But I've given up fretting about that. I did a lot of fretting about that sort of thing in the first half of my career. I think the more people I can train and educate, and the more, even if patients would never dream of doing the course, the more they know that my, you know, Cancer Vibe Education Centre, which is the department of my organisation that will be running the course, the more people even know it exists or talk about it, it's so heartening for people who are looking for something other than something that's going to make them feel absolutely rotten and maybe worse, and not to have to feel that they're probably pretty stupid doing that and maybe they shouldn't. There's that amazing book, Mum's Not Having Chemo.
Yes.
It's got a lot of things in there. It doesn't tell you how to do any of them. It's written by her daughter, who's an investigative journalist. But it just shows you how many other things there are and how sensible it could be to explore them.
Mm.
So it's going through on Seyfried's side and the science, and it's going through on books like that.
Yeah.
And then another book really got me interested was this terribly serious-looking book, Sensitization of Cancer Cells for Chemo, Immuno and Radiation. And it's the entire book almost is about different ways of making different drugs to use to make cells more sensitive to cancer and radiation.
Mm.
And then plumb in the middle, chapter 14, you find natural agents that can sensitize tumor cells to chemotherapy and radiation therapy. I don't suppose many people in the metabolic biochemical approach will find it, so I put it in the BSIO newsletter.
Right. Tucked away
because,
there.
Because it's right here in mainstream anti-cancer, cancer, you know, research book.
Mm, interesting. So just going back to your trajectory of your own life, your training and your work and everything, you could say in a certain kind of way that up to a certain point you were right in the mainstream, and that when you went to Australia and struck out with naturopathy.
Well, I was in the mainstream for 10 years in the mining industry.
Right.
I was one of the only, I think, two women geochemists in mining and mineral and oil exploration all over the Southern Hemisphere. Right. I was all over the Southern Hemisphere.
Right. So I'm just interested to what made you want to look outside of mainstream, if you like. Naturopathy is definitely outside of the mainstream.
Chemistry. It was biochemistry.
Well, I can see that, but what particularly led you towards these natural approaches as opposed to chemical approaches?
When I came back to do the second master's degree at Imperial, I didn't come back to do that. I came back to be in London for a year or two and was looking for something. And I was working again at Imperial and got in with some people who were interested in what the World Health Organization at that time was doing, things like trying to create protein out of cauliflowers in Indian villages with a machine and things like this. You know, we all thought starvation was a protein problem, whereas in fact it was a pure food problem. But they managed to market their milk powders and things to in that. And I'd been used to, in my first job in Otago, because I was working for the Geological Survey, a good salary and a good income and a good car. Came back on this, I think I had £11 a week to live on, and £7.10 a week was the rent. So I sort of became a vegetarian then because it was cheapest. And then being slightly bored with that second research master's, I started looking at amino acid balancing in different grains and the like. So that you know, that was pure chemistry working out which amino acids went with which. Somewhere along the line, it occurred to me if I ever got ill, I'd never go see a doctor. I'd try and get the right things in the body. Mm-hmm. Then also when I was out in Australia after the second master's degree, it was about 1968 at this point, I'd taken an interest in gardening here, but I hadn't yet owned a property. In Perth, I owned a property. The Perth soil is pure laterite. Trying to grow a vegetable garden on that is ridiculous. Met up with this wonderful couple, the Cresses. For some reason, they adopted me, sort of.
Right.
He was a metallurgist, or he was definitely working on the factory floor in some machine factory type thing, and his German was good, his English wasn't quite so good, and he prodded around, somehow he got an idea that I was worth spending time with, and then he came along to my property every Saturday and we put it all together and showed me how to make soil out of all this and do compost and what. They were a delightful couple, they were super. And then on one day he said, right, this is the garden's ready now, on Wednesday you can put in the carrot seeds. I said, what do you mean Wednesday? Let's do it now. No, the moon's not right. I said, what do you mean the moon's not right? You know, I'm a pure scientist at this point, in the geological survey, working with straight-out geologists. So I then went away, because I had over an acre of garden. It was quite a rural spot I had. And I dug up a square metre, exactly the same, and I put carrot seeds in every Wednesday for a couple of months. And by golly, the first month a week they grew, the next week ones grew, the next week one, the fourth week grew, the fifth week's one shot up and got level with the second week. So I thought, okay, there's something in it. And I thought, now there's, being a scientist is not a technologist. It's not, I know how it works, therefore it works. Hmm. It's, if it works every time, there's something in it.
Right.
And so then I got more interested. Then he gave me all these various books by Rudolf Steiner.
Biodynamics.
And it was biodynamics. And I thought, this is all a bit wacky, but he's been so nice to me, I'd better read it all.
Right.
And then I got more and more interested in it. And that probably, I mean, I accept now that I'm a spirit temporarily in this physical body. I quite like it. I want it to hold together for a bit longer, but I don't talk about dying. And that went along working with the... because I spent a lot of time reading that extensively. In the survey in West Australia, we'd go camping for 2 months at a time and then come in for a week. three times during the winter. And I would be there in a tent with, say, a field crew of four or six guys who'd go off getting samples or they're doing whatever. And I had to take a lot of books in. There wasn't much else to do in the middle of the West Australian desert. So one time I took a whole lot of his books. I really did get drawn to the idea of working with nature, not battling against it, with the human body and not battling against it. I hadn't yet decided to be, to do naturopathy or anything. That came about a year or two later after I'd moved to Sydney. But it did give me that slant to it, yes. And also, come to think of it, I, as a student here in 1959, I suspect, I had a summer holiday job in Hammersmith Hospital as a sort of gopher student, as one does as a student. And somebody had spilt radioactive iodine in the corridor sometime about 10 o'clock in the morning, they recognised afterwards, without knowing it. And it was lying in the corridor, and I, of course, as a student, was going up and down, going, catch, get this, fetch this. Somebody at about 3 in the afternoon walked down with a Geiger counter switched on, luckily, and it went off scale. So we all had all our badges checked, because we had a wrist badge and a collar badge and things, and it was my job at the end of each day anyway to measure them. So on this occasion at 3:30, I was measuring everybody's, and what I did get to see, otherwise I mightn't have known it, was that compared to the others, mine was way off scale with radioactive iodine. Then they gave us potassium iodide tablets and iodine solution to drink. And if we hadn't already damaged our thyroid with the radioactive iodine, we now did. It was masses of iodine going in, too late, probably. And a year or two later, when I was out in Australia, or sometime later, my thyroid completely packed up. It packed up to the point that it took me half an hour to crawl from the bed to get to the telephone halfway across the room. And I was put on massive thyroxine. And then when I was working in South Africa, I met an anthroposophical doctor there who said, no, you want this thing that will rebalance the thyroid. And within about 3 years, my thyroid worked perfectly. Now, I know it was a bad accident, a particularly bad one, because when I was here, about 10 years ago, I was at a concert in the Albert Hall and chap in the next box, and I got talking in the interval. And he said he worked in Hammersmith Hospital. I said, oh, I used to, and told him this. God, he said, were you in that accident?
Right.
And I said, gosh, was it really bad? Also, no, he said, no. There was no talking about it.
Wow.
I wasn't going to go and claim expense, anything or other. But hey, that told me just how effective that sort of approach could be.
Interesting.
And my very first patient with cancer, about 1980, before I really had studied it, and we had a tiny little book, about A5 in size and about 40 pages thick. It was all we could teach on cancer. I mean, 40 years ago, we didn't have money more other things. He was given 4 months to live maximum with his lymphatic cancer all through him, and his heart wouldn't last 4 months anyway. And in any case, there was nothing anybody could do for his lymphatic cancer. And he came to see me, and he had been on intravenous vitamin C for, I don't know how long, three, 4 weeks, something like that. And then the doctor who'd been giving it had moved out of Sydney. He'd moved way off into the country. And he sent the chap to me because he didn't know what else to do with him. And 4 months to live. And he said, the sad thing is he was a potter. And he had been up in the Northern Territory collecting all the Aboriginal stories of their pottery. And he said, I'm never going to write the book now, because, of course, he was exhausted. He got terribly boring for the oncologist. They then got enough energy and his heart got better. They moved 400 miles inland. And when I was out that way shortly before I came back here, they said, oh, you must come and spend the day. And I said, okay. And we went to the kitchen having lunch. What are we having? Salad, you told us. Where's the what dressing? Olive oil, flaxseed oil, you told us. Where is it kept in the deep freeze, you told us. What are we drinking? Red clover tea, you told us. He had done every little thing that I had said with the limited tools in hand. And I say to patients, never underestimate the error and the damage of the tiniest break in your diet or the benefit of the tiniest benefit.
Improvement, yeah.
And I now have his book in the shelf over there.
He did it.
On pottery. Mm. He lived 14 years and his heart gave out in the end.
Impressive. So let's come back to your course again now. Just want to give a rounded picture to people who are listening, who are interested. They've heard about you, they've heard about what your aims are for this course. So what can you just tell them what they're to expect to learn during the course, what they're going to come out with at the other end? And you related quite a bit of it to your books and everything, and maybe that'll be helpful as well.
It'll be a sort of a spine on which it's built, but it'll go way beyond that,
okay.
Of course.
All right.
Well, we know that cancer is caused by errors of lifestyle. Well over 90%. Some people are at 93%, 95%, whatever. And most of our diet is errors of lifestyle. So, you know, we'll go through, for instance, things like the role of glucose. People say, well, sugar's bad for you, but we'll understand why it's bad for you and what you can do instead. And that people think that if they cook food slowly and gently, it doesn't matter. But if you cook food above the sort of 40 degrees, a really hot summer's day, then you break down a few vitamins, maybe, but enzymes are like a key in the lock, and the little bit of heat just changes that key a little bit, and then it just jams up the lock. So they'll get to understand how to change their diet, why to change their diet, and super alternative things to put in. We went out last night to this raw food restaurant. We had a feast. And I tell you, my web designer chap was very nervous about this whole thing because he came out saying, "What's that? That's kale. Goo, I hate kale, but this is delicious." And, you know, I wrote a book. I have written the book and I keep writing it, called Food for Life, which is about 200 recipes of raw food, low starch raw food, because all the raw food books are full of bananas and dates and starches. So we may well, within the course, have you know, people going home and learning cooking techniques and coming back in, but okay. That's not the serious part. But it's, you can't just say to patients, you've got to do all these things. You've got to make their life really exciting afterwards. I've had so many people say, "Gosh, a whole new world of restaurants in London now. So many raw food restaurants." Mm. So they will do all of that. We'll look at what I've called predisposing factors. It's not the same as risk factors, like, you know, cigarettes are a risk factor, okay. And being female or having babies or something is a risk factor. But predisposing factors, we need to look at the way people's digestion works, because you can put food down there, but if it's not absorbed, it's not going to work. There's no point in taking supplements if you can't absorb them. Where the liver works. People get appalled at the idea of doing enemas, for instance. I had somebody here, actually it was a Skype conversation this morning, and she'd sort of said, I'm not doing an enema. And I said, look, if we don't do a detox of some sort like that, we can't afford to do things that will break down tumour cells, because you'll have all that toxins in the blood. And I was at a conference one time where this oncologist presented a paper. He said, we found this really new, really good new chemical drug. He said, we lose a few patients to TLS. And I said, after the question, what's TLS? And of course, everybody laughed at me because I should have known. Doctors did. It's called tumor lysis syndrome, and it's caused when you break down tumors and poison your patients, and they die. Mm. So I'd said to this patient, look, I'd really like to help you in this way, but if you don't do the enemas, I'm not doing it. Anyway, she finally overcame this and told me this morning she did one about a week ago, and she said, after that one, I felt so fantastic. Exactly. I sat right down and did another one.
She
had planned now is a double morning and night. She is seriously ill, but she's refused all the other therapies, and her doctor has said, that's fine, if that's what you want, she'd, you know, go along with it, but didn't think it was a good idea. But one oncologist I spoke to said, no, he said, we're all having to learn, more and more of our patients are wanting to do a metabolic biochemical approach.
Hallelujah.
Yes. I wish more were, but it's happening.
Yeah, it's coming
so
from the ground
up.
So
we look at those sort of things, and why, and how to make it fun. And then things like diabetics are more inclined to get more likely to get cancer. And William Kelly has an interesting point of view. He says, look, diabetes is a pancreatic deficiency of insulin output. And you didn't, because luckily Banting and the others who discovered insulin, or took it from the people who did discover it really, were medical doctors. So they were believed, and it went into the medical repertoire. He said pancreas, in his view, cancer is a pancreatic deficiency of pancreatic enzyme disease. Absolutely parallel. And you can draw, I've done it and it's going in the book I'm working on at the moment, parallels between the two. So you've got to sort of go through making sure the liver works properly, making sure the pancreas works properly, and making sure that they, if they're diabetic, we manage it. I've had one woman who was, well, she wouldn't tell me what she was, but she's gone from a size 18 down to a size 10. And her insulin has gone down from about, well, no, her blood sugar level has gone down from about 12 to about 5. And a whole lot of other things have improved. And she, you know, you can do all that. She's stopped her insulin entirely, and she's halved her dose of metformin last time I spoke to her. So you get the pancreas put right, the blood sugar put right, hypoglycemia stopped. Then you move on, you need the thyroid right, because that balance is normalized. Having any of these things wrong, or your estrogen 216 levels wrong, or your immune system not functioning properly, they're all predisposing factors to making you more likely to get cancer. Well, that's where you start. You don't start with, we can give you a, you know, you don't start a new garden in a paddock by putting delicate little bulbs in one corner. And then in cancer, in the sort of the next segments, as how it will work out, I don't know. We do look at the work of Beard and Warburg and William Kelly, dentist. But you see, the trouble with this metabolic approach is not been figured out by doctors.
No.
Beard's an embryologist, Warburg is a biochemist, Kelly's a dentist. So the doctors don't pay any attention to them, but the Banting insulin one they did. And then I'm assuming that everybody that comes will know what all the vitamins do and all the minerals do in the body and
all
the superfoods.
Receive
yes.
Proper training.
So we have looked at them, and it took us 4 days. We looked at how each of them plays a role on how the mitochondria functions, because a lot of cancer is a mitochondrial disorder, and we now know more and more. Men's health problems are mitochondrial based. You'll have come across that a whole lot. But what I'm finding is that actually they don't know what all those things do. So then we'll have to stop, and I won't stop for everybody. If there's only one in the class that doesn't know, I'll tell them where to go and read it. But, you know, if the class doesn't understand how resveratrol works in the electron transport chain, then we'll follow it through. Not to the level of being clever chemists, but so that they can feel really comfortable about prescribing or recommending. I've said all my life in this career, 40 years, to students and to patients, patients don't really have to know how it works, but they need to know somebody knows how it works.
Yes.
And that somebody needs to know more about how it works if they're the practitioner. But if they're really stuck, know that there is somebody else, me in this case, who does know and can help, who, when I get stuck, which of course does happen, or any of us, knows how to get to the books and to find out or to go on the internet. I mean, my first 20 years, we didn't have an internet.
Oh, different world.
How we learned, you know, I used to go across America every year to come back to my beloved aunt in Ireland for Christmas or some other time. And I'd go to a series of labs or conferences or things on the way, because it was the only way you could get to know what was going on. So, you know, that's where it is now. Now, that was Sunday, today's Friday. By Christmas, this could have really grown into something bigger.
Right.
But I've got to stay realistic. We know where we can have it if a dozen people want to do the course, or we can have it bigger if more, and we'll use other premises I've got in mind. But I do want to keep it to enough, you know, say 20 people perhaps, so there will be a waiting list before long. There are already 2 or 3 people signed up for it. Because I want the people to get individual, you know, question time and answer time.
So you're going to move people from being qualified nutritionists or naturopaths,
yes,
to a point where they have both practical experience and the knowledge to go support forward. People with cancer.
And beyond that, for a lot of them, it will help them in all the other health problems too, right, that relate to all of that.
Of course.
And as somebody else said to me last night, who said, right, she wants to do the course, she said, I'm not quite sure yet if I want to specialise in cancer. But she said, a lot of the patients that I will have, some will have cancer, but she said, in any case, if I'm starting out in my career, if I have patients 10 years later, half my practice will have cancer, because that's statistic.
That's the way it's going, yeah.
So if you don't know how to deal with cancer, every so often you're going to say, look, I'm sorry, I can't help you anymore, because I really don't know what to do. And at the moment, people have come, I've done a number of the SL1 and 2s out of town as well as here, and on one of them, several people said, oh, I've got several patients with cancer, and I asked what they were doing, and it was, there needs to be more training. Needs to be more training.
Okay, well, it's a fantastic job you're doing. I think we're probably out of time now to talk about it, but it's very inspiring that you've taken this huge project on at this point in your career, but it's brilliant, because of course you're going to be able to pass on all of your experience.
I'm not sure it's inspiring. I think it's self-indulgent, because I love what I do, and I love training and teaching and sharing.
Well, great. Well, that's very lucky for everybody else.
Doing all of that. I don't know how many times I'll run the course. I've got a free bus pass and then some. But
right. So get in quick, sign up.
Yes, that's true.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks very much indeed for telling us about it.
Pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you for having me here. It's been good to chat. Good to, for me to revive some of the memories of how I got here.
Thank you. Zandria has an extraordinary energy and zeal to spread her accumulated wealth of knowledge and experience, and to inspire a new generation of sorely needed experts to provide support for the growing numbers of people affected by cancer every year. As usual, relevant links for today's show will be on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. I'd just like to finish the show by thanking all the supporters of Yes to Life who've made it possible for us to help more people than ever in 2016 and for us to put on some of the best events we've ever done. The immense amount of appreciation we receive for the help and information is our assurance that it's absolutely needed and valued. A personal thank you from me to you all. And I anticipate that, as ever, 2017 will be another step on for Yes to Life and for integrative medicine in Britain. Goodbye.